You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of August, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Emma Nelson, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's time for us to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know. Today we're joined by Raffaello Pantucci. Raffaello, what do you have for us?
Well, this morning we're going to be talking about Silvio Berlusconi and his conviction at last, the former Italian Prime Minister. We're going to talk about Edward Snowden and what this means for US-Russia relations. And we're going to talk about Iraq and the fact that last month was the bloodiest in 5 years.
Thanks very much indeed. Also coming up, how do you heal the scars of a country's past? We'll ask just how helpful a Truth and Reconciliation Commission can be.
Courts, to begin with, are always focused more on the accused rather than in the victim. And there is really not much space there for the victim. So what truth commissions do is to turn the focus on the victim and to validate the experiences of the victim.
We'll also hear from the author who spent what seemed like an eternity living with birds to assess the history of man's relationship with our feathery friends.
And later in the program, we'll bring you the final instalment of our series of summer postcards as heads of government head off on their summer holidays. Today, we're in Japan.
All that plus we're going to play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. So a very busy Friday edition of Midori House to get through. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The United States has announced it'll be closing a number of embassies this coming Sunday because of security concerns. State Department spokeswoman Mari Harf called the step precautionary, but she gave no details of specific threats or of which missions would be closed.
The Department of State has instructed certain U.S. embassies and consulates to remain closed or to suspend operations on Sunday, August 4th. The department has been apprised of information that, out of an abundance of caution and care for our employees and others who may be visiting our installations, that indicates we should institute these precautionary steps. The department, when conditions warrant, takes steps like this to balance our continued operations with security and safety.
Ariel Castro, the Cleveland bus driver who abducted, imprisoned and tortured three women, has been sentenced to life in prison, plus 1,000 years with no parole. The sentence came after one of his victims confronted him, saying he'd put her through 11 years of hell. 32-year-old Michelle Knight, whom Castro forced to miscarry during pregnancy, made a dramatic appearance in court before the sentencing and read out a written statement.
Ariel Castro, I remember all the times that you came home talking about what everybody else did wrong and act like you wasn't doing the same thing. You said, at least I didn't kill you. For you took 11 years of my life away, and I have got it back. I spent 11 years in hell. Now your hell is just beginning. I will overcome all this that happened, but you will face hell for eternity.
Italy's former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi says a prison sentence against him for tax fraud confirmed by the country's Supreme Court was completely unfounded. After a three-day hearing, the five judges rejected Berlusconi's final appeal against the verdict handed down by two lower courts in Milan, which sentenced him to 4 years in jail, commuted to 1 year under an amnesty. In a video message, Berlusconi said he didn't deserve this treatment. He again denied any wrongdoing and said he'd always fulfilled his duties at work and in public life. He said he'd been the target of persecution by magistrates ever since his entry into politics 2 decades ago, but he'd continue his political struggle and strive for reforms of the justice system. Tunisian troops have exchanged fire with militants near the Algerian border 3 days after gunmen killed 8 soldiers in one of the deadliest attacks on the country's security forces in decades. Soldiers had been doing security sweeps since Monday in Mount Chambi, a remote area where the army's been trying to track down Islamist militants since last December. The rise in instability comes at a period of political turmoil in Tunisia, which has seen large protests against the moderate Islamist-led government. Earlier on the day, Algerian media said Algeria had boosted its military presence near the border in coordination with Tunisian security forces because of increased tensions in the area. A mining company in Australia has been found guilty of desecrating an Aboriginal site in the Northern Territory and fined $150,000. OM Manganese was accused of causing the collapse of part of the Two Women Sitting Down site near Tennant's Creek in July 2011. Prosecutors say the company used explosives to break up ground close to the site. The company has apologised, saying it regrets the damage and the hurt caused and never intended to harm, damage or disrespect the sacred site. 15 years after Washington DC's medical marijuana law was passed by voters, the first dispensary has opened in the US Capitol. Capital City Care began selling pharmaceutical-grade organic medical marijuana to local residents of the District of Columbia on Thursday. David A. Gard, Capital Care's general manager, says many people are set to benefit.
Every person out there has a member of their family that has cancer, that has gone through MS or something like that, something devastating, an aunt or uncle, a mother, a father. And, you know, I have a personal connection to it with my best friend who died in 2005 from brain cancer. And when you see someone go through, you know, life with something like that and then go through death, you realize how impactful medical marijuana can be on people's lives and how much it can truly help their day-to-day and in a great time of need.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. It's just approaching 7 minutes past the hour. You're with Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It's time now for us to set the day's news agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Monocle regular Raffaella Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Good morning, Raffaella, and happy Friday to you. Should we begin with Berlusconi?
I guess we have to. I mean, as a half Italian myself, the Berlusconi story is, I'll be honest, one that I have been avoiding in general because it's such a saga and it just seems to emblemize so many of the negative things about Italy or the sort of public perceptions about them. But, you know, we have today a very big deal. He's finally been convicted for a tax fiddle. This is, you know, last year we saw him convicted for underage sex, consorting with Ruby the Heart Sealer, Ruby Rubacuori. He's appealing that decision. But this time it appears that, you know, he's not got really many appeals to go. He's finally run the end of it. He's been convicted of basically overpaying in some way for the rights of some TV shows. And this has been, you know, calculated to be some sort of tax fiddle. What this means, well, you know, it's he's a 76-year-old man, so it's unlikely he's going to get sent to jail. He'll probably be put under house arrest, and given his considerable means, one suspects that's going to be quite a gilded cage.
There was talk of him doing some community service, which filled me with delight.
I know. One wonders what exactly they'll have him doing, picking up garbage, and
helping an old lady with her gardening. Let's have a listen to a little bit of Mr. Berlusconi sounding very angry indeed.
Devo dire che viviamo davvero in un paese in cui la maggior parte dei reati, dei crimini, non vengono neppure perseguiti. Un paese che non sa essere giusto, soprattutto verso I cittadini.
Silvio Arrabbiato there. Raffaello, your name belies the fact that you speak Italian. What was he saying there?
Well, he was saying, you know, we live in a country where you know, the majority of crimes go unpunished. It's a sense of victimization. He feels that the entire judiciary is persecuting him for political reasons. And this is often what he says. He accuses certain judges of being not driven by the law, but driven instead by sort of deeper political motives. And he accuses the sort of left wing of attacking him. I mean, there is a bigger sort of political story here potentially brewing as well, which is what this means for the ruling coalition in Italy.
Because his loyalists, the PDL party, have already threatened to potentially destabilize the government.
Exactly. I mean, they're part of the government, you know, and then there is a question of what it means for them if they start accusing it. But then on the other side of the equation, people who are part of the coalition may begin to wonder, well, do we really want to be in alliance in a government with a convicted felon?
There'll be a judicial review into whether he is allowed to hold public office anymore.
Yes, that's the one sort of silver lining in this cloud for him.
Yes, he wasn't. Bless him, lucky man.
Yeah, I know.
What does this mean for Italy now? I mean, the legal trials and tribulations have been going on for, what, 2 decades involving Berlusconi. Yes. As you've just said, this is potentially drawing a line under at least one of these episodes. But does this mean that Berlusconi is down and out, or would that just be just too ridiculous to contemplate that Berlusconi is gone?
I think it's always too early to call him out. I mean, he's repeatedly shown time and again a capacity to come back and surprise us all. I mean, I think the bigger, you know, in terms of this, if this is the end of him, I mean, he's a 76-year-old man. You know, people come to... Quite a vigorous one. Well, yes, if we go by his virility, then certainly it's...
But many Italians, they still do seem to have a love affair with Berlusconi in one way or another.
I mean, the last election, his party still won the biggest number of votes, you know what I mean? So he's still able to control and command a certain vote. I mean, this is the thing. He's sort of, it's this whole debate at the middle of Italy of what Italy actually wants to be. There is a perception of him as a sort of very successful businessman, as this very virile man. And this sort of plays to some Italian self-perceptions that are sort of quite strong. But at the same time, all the sort of tax fiddle stories, all the allegations of links to the mafia, these stories with the underage girls. I mean, his wife, you know, finally left him over some of the stories that he'd been dating, you know, underage, 16 or 17-year-olds. I mean, you know, it's a very sort of complicated picture, but it does sort of paint an interesting portrait of sort of modern Italy.
There's all that, when you talk about modern Italy, there is that lovely idea of good Italy, or not lovely idea, but good idea of good Italy, bad Italy, and Berlusconi being the man who personifies the self-serving, backhanding, you know, greased palm of Italian culture. How much do you think that the final conviction of Berlusconi will perhaps improve Italy's world image?
I don't know, to be honest. I have a feeling it probably won't. I have a feeling it's probably not going to change much of the sort of global perception of Italy. I think that from a sort of international perspective, I think that this is just, I imagine a lot of people looking at this going, haven't we heard this story before? You know, and so I don't know if necessarily there's any sense that, you know, I think if he actually went to jail, you know, was physically put in a jail and we saw him behind bars, that might have some sort of impact. But the fact that, you know, we're probably going to see him maybe doing community service, which I imagine would be quite light. He'll be living in one of his large houses. This is not, you know, a man going to serve hard time for crime served. This is a man who has sort of run out the judicial process, if you will.
And Raphael, let's move on to another story which a lot of people are talking about. Edward Snowden, he's left Moscow airport. Democratic senator, New York Democratic senator Chuck Schumer calls it a stab in the back with what Russia allowed Snowden to do. How devastating is this for Russian-American relations?
Well, it's potentially very negative. I mean, U.S.-Russia relations are always on a sort of a teetering edge, if you will, because they have this, you know, difficult spying relationships. All these allegations are there. There's this sort of constant needling in the UNSC, the sort of disagreements over Syria, over Iran, over other issues. And the Snowden story has sort of played perfectly into this. And the fact that now the Russians have given him asylum and he's actually come into the country from, you know, lurking around the airport for the last 5 weeks, sorry. You know, a lot of Americans are seeing this very negative thing. And, you know, we had Jay Carney, the U.S., the sort of spokesman for the president, say that, you know, they're going to have to call into question whether they're going to bother doing a bilateral summit with the Russians in September. Mm. President Obama's going to be there anyway for the G20 in St. Petersburg. But, you know, because he's visiting the country, usually the form is you have a sort of bilateral one-on-one with the local leader. He's saying, we might not do that. We might just go home because this is really a negative.
And some American politicians are even pressuring the president to actually lobby to move the G20 away from St. Petersburg.
Yes, and they're saying that they shouldn't, U.S. athletes should, you know, boycott the Sochi Olympics in 2014, the sort of Winter Olympics. I mean, this is a little, I think, extreme, and I'd be surprised if these sorts of things happen. But I think the bigger point is that there is a tension with the U.S.-Russia relations that, you know, they tried to reset with that famous button-giving incident in 2009. But, you know, it doesn't actually seem to have worked, and we've continued to see this very strong tension. And, you know, it's funny, it seems like a throwback to sort of the Cold War, you know, is it Russia and US pairing off against each other?
It doesn't look like American can come out well whichever option it takes, because if Obama does express his anger publicly to the degree that apparently he has expressed it privately, that will look like churlishness. But if they sort of almost accept it with good grace, it will look like they're letting Snowden go. How does the US get out of this?
Well, I mean, I think that frankly, the US hasn't really got a very good hand in this whole Snowden, NSA and everything else saga. I mean, you know, when We often talk about China when I come here. And, you know, the Chinese had a field day over the Snowden incident because, you know, they get the Americans pointing fingers about cyber to them. And they're like, well, hey, you've been collecting all the information on the internet for years. You know, so it's a very difficult sort of dilemma there. And here with Russia as well, you know, they can point lots of fingers and say, oh, you Russians, you know, all you naughty spying and all these other things. Well, you know, the Russians say, well, look, you're persecuting this guy who was revealing to the world something that you were doing that was wrong. There's no real way that the U.S. can necessarily come out of this well.
And finally, Raphael, another story which has got your attention. Staggering death toll out of Iraq from the last month. Nearly 1,000 people killed, the highest in 5 years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is in many ways a story that's been bubbling on for a very long time. I mean, the danger and violence, the level of violence and intensity of it in Iraq has been at a very high pitch for a very long time. But because Western forces left in, I think it was 2006, the sort of public's eye has left disappeared from this story. It sort of disappeared from public view, but it has been going on with events in Syria and the sort of civil war there that's been escalating across the border. You know, the sort of the up-tempo violence in Iraq has been increasing. We've seen two large-scale prison breaks in the past few weeks. Some very senior members of Al-Qaeda in Iraq freed from the famous Abu Ghraib prison. And we've seen this sort of growing, you know, number of sectarian violence, the growing number of coordinated suicide bombings, coordinated bombing, you know, like five bombings in the same city killing, you know, dozens of people. And, you know, no one's really noticing. And it's now getting as bad as that. And so it does begin to call into question what, you know, what was the sort of, what was the result of the effort in Iraq all those years ago? And number two, what really does this all mean for what's happening in Syria and how Syria is going to have an impact on its sort of broader region?
Raffaella Pantucci from RUSI, thank you very much as ever for joining us.
Coming up, as Canada's investigation into abuses of Indigenous people in the country releases its latest findings, we'll ask how effective Truth and Reconciliation Commissions really are. That's right after this.
The ancient practice of agriculture meets modern metropolis as we explore groundbreaking urban farms in Tokyo, Brooklyn, and Oslo. Monocle Films visits the people bringing green growth to their thriving cities.
Everywhere you look, something is growing. There's Japanese pumpkin and bitter melon dangling from trellises, and eggplant sprouting in the lobby. Tomatoes hang from a conference room ceiling, and papaya and passion fruit trees double as partitions for meeting areas.
Seeds in the City, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:17 a.m. Now, Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is investigating allegations of abuse in the country's First Nations communities, released its latest findings last week. Indigenous or First Nations children were subjected to medical experiments at the country's schools. That's according to the chairman of Canada's Truth Commission.
But Canada isn't the only country in the world to try and bridge the gap with past wrongdoings. Countries from Grenada to El Salvador, Peru to South Korea have all had their own versions of truth commissions in one form or another. So, are they effective? And what if a nation opts not to revisit dark chapters in their past in this way? Well, earlier, Monocle's Pauline Eiferman spoke to Eduardo Gonzalez. He is from the Truth and Memory Program at the International Center for Transitional Justice, and she began by asking him about the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Well, I think the process of the commission is still not completely finished. They have to issue and publicize a comprehensive final report, and they still have a couple of national events that they are going to run in the next few months. But the process of the Canadian Commission is particularly important because this is the first truth commission that is focused exclusively on the question of how Indigenous peoples, or Aboriginals as they are called in Canada, have been treated historically. This is a commission focused specifically on the forced cultural assimilation of children. And the other very significant point here is that truth commissions generally have been created after armed conflict or after dictatorship. You could argue that it is strange that Canada does it because it has not had a conflict or a dictatorship. But if you look at the history of Canada from the perspective of First Nations, probably the kind of atrocities and violations they suffered are for them as comparable to the violations that people who had dictatorships suffered. We are talking about a population whose children were taken away from them and subjected to mistreatment and to cultural assimilation.
And why is it a good idea to start a commission to investigate these past events?
Well, when there are atrocities of the scale that we are talking about, that is, atrocities that victimize a specific sector of the population, that are widespread in the territory of a country, etc., typically your first response is to make sure that there will be an investigation carried out by the courts of the country that we are talking about. However, there are some problems with that approach, because courts, to begin with, are always focused more on the accused rather than in the victim. A court is supposed to be a fair procedure to establish the guilt of the accused or the non-guilt of the accused. And there is really not much space there for the victim. So what truth commissions do is to turn the focus on the victim and to validate the experiences of the victim. A truth commission then is not so much focused on the questions of formal fairness and equity that a court must have. It's more focused on substantive issues of validating the experiences of people who have suffered. So that is one important thing. The second is probably that in these kind of situations, in the eve of these situations, there are always sectors who try to deny what happened and deny it to strengthen their political position, to avoid the disprestige associated to human rights violations. So it is critical, precisely because of that, to cast light over what happened so that people who committed this kind of atrocities or were complicit with this kind of atrocities do not have the privilege of complete impunity. It is important that the history is known so that people understand the reasons why this happened, the responsibilities for what happened, and they have a better chance at avoiding its repetition.
And some of the countries that we wanted to ask you about were Australia, Lebanon, who hasn't had a truth commission since the Civil War, and then South Africa. Can you talk about how these countries differed in their approach?
Well, perhaps the South African experience is the most well-known. It is well-known because of the visibility of some of the actors who participated there, like Bishop Tutu. But it's also well-known because people have an idea that in South Africa there was this sort of historic trade-off between truth and justice. That is, that the South African Commission was predicated on the notion that perpetrators would be forgiven if they told the truth. Now, of course, there is a difference in cases like Lebanon where you have not had this kind of inquiry. There are many cases where this has not happened. I mean, think of countries who have had colonial responsibilities in recent decades. The war in Algeria by France, the war in Vietnam by France and the US, the war in Kenya by the British Empire, and so on and so forth. There are a number of situations where you have not had truth. Not to go too far, also the so-called war on terror unleashed by the United States also has not had any kind of revisiting there. And the problem when that does not happen is that a society misses an opportunity to learn. That is, there is not an opportunity to understand what are the mechanisms behind a mass human rights violation so that you can avoid it, but also you miss an opportunity to empathize with the victim and to understand the humanity of the victims. If you don't do that, then society is going to continue considering that certain people do not deserve the same protections, that certain people are not as human as you, and that is precisely the seed of future atrocity. I think that what a truth commission does is an opportunity, it gives you an opportunity to learn.
Eduardo Gonzalez there from the Truth and Memory program at the International Center of Transitional Justice.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. Now, everyone knows about dogs being man's best friend, but what about birds, Emma?
Big fan.
Big fan of
Huge
birds.
Huge fan of birds. Well, love a bird.
Birds and their relationship with humans have perhaps had had bad press, not least due to the work of Alfred Hitchcock and their habit of perhaps relieving themselves from a great height on shoulders, heads, and your smartest outfit. But the wildlife author Mark Cocker hopes to remedy this.
Mark has written a book simply and appropriately titled Birds and People. Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck met Mark in our studios here at Midori House to discuss, among other things, which bird they'd want to see back from extinction.
Mark, thank you very much for coming in to see us. Now, there are many books that have been brought out about the world of ornithology and birds, but the link with people is one that's not really been explored ever in this depth. Can you just tell us a little bit about the idea for the book, what you're trying to tell people?
You know, as you say, most books are about biology and the ecology of birds or their conservation status. But what we wanted to do was to look at a different kind of aspect to it, and that is essentially two great tranches of encounter between people and birds. One is a very practical one. We have eaten birds since time immemorial, and today on the planet there are 12 billion chickens, and they supply us with 90 million tons of meat every year, and that's the most important source of protein. So birds are incredibly practical. They serve many functional economic purposes, but they also serve a myriad of purposes. And the best way to summarize it is the anthropologist, French anthropologist, Claude Levi-Strauss said birds were good to eat, but they were also good to think. And that really expresses it, that birds have enabled us to express all kinds of ideas about life, our experience, our own inner world, really. But we also added one further dimension, which is literally to say to the world, please tell us what birds mean to you. And we invited everyone and eventually got 650 people from 81 countries to send us their stories about birds, which we've embedded in the text to create a kind of global chorus on how birds function in these much more subtle and interesting and fascinating and positive ways.
A very touching small story from one of the people who did reply to you is that the story of Granny the Swallow. And I think that just kind of, it made the link between birds and the mystery of birds really important. And this is the story, isn't it, of somebody who their family try and spot the first swallow each year.
Yeah, no, that's a fabulous story. I mean, what happened was they live on a farm and the swallow returns every year, which is a fundamentally important experience across the entire Northern Hemisphere. Let's just stress that. But this particular family, their granny, her favourite bird was the swallow. And when the swallow returns to the farm, it's like Granny is returning, and the lucky person who spots the bird sends out a text to the rest of the family, and it just simply says, Granny's back. And I think it's a classic example of two things. First of all, birds function in very private ways for people. You know, very individual, familial context here, a whole family sharing this sense of family tradition with a swallow. But what that taps into is a much larger thing, that swallows are signifiers of season. And that moment in the Northern Hemisphere when the ice creaks apart and life starts again, and that's what swallows bring. And that's a very powerful universal encounter and experience. But this is both universal and private. And I think that's a fabulous story.
After doing this book, did you come to any conclusions about why some birds cross over from the realm of being, you know, the little brown spot at the end of the garden to being more important to us? So here in the UK, for example, we have the robin, a bird which, you know, people would never willingly hurt, and has you know, it pops up in our Christmas cards, but. And perhaps because we've never heard it, it does have where we are at Midori House here in London, there's a robin that comes down into the garden and will come by your feet while you're eating your lunch. It's like generations of not being touched have left this bird with a kind of a willingness to kind of come right up to you. Did you understand why some birds make this extraordinary journey?
Yes. I mean, in the case of the robin, it's red. I mean, one of the critical indicators of why we respond to birds is certain colours have a magical, and I mean it's almost magical, impact upon us. And those colours are red and blue. So you find very often, in fact, you find me a blue bird that doesn't have cultural status and significance. Blue is a powerful and extraordinary colour for us. And so is red, because it's associated with life and death. And you think of all the political parties that use red in their colour. So red is charged with power. And this bird behaves as if we were its friends. And one of the critical things about that is the British robin is fundamentally distinct from European robins. It's a separate race, and it behaves in this incredibly confiding way, and it doesn't do so elsewhere. Because there is this closeness between us, actually they're only after food, which we provide for them. That's all they're doing. But we feel they love us, and we love them, and we've built up this reciprocity. But I mean, typically in medieval Germany, they probably ate robins, and certainly in southern Europe, in the Mediterranean region, they would eat robins. So not everyone feels it. But you are right to draw a distinction between the way some birds have this powerful hold over us and other birds don't. And as I say, very often it's rooted in colour and often confiding behaviours, or they're great to eat.
Now, I think you say there are 10,500 different varieties of bird in the world at the moment. And without going down a negative route, how do you feel that their future looks? Do you feel it's reasonably bright? We know that actually in many parts of the world, you know, deforestation is happening at a pace which is still uncontrollable. But do you think that people are beginning to recognise the value of these birds?
Well, the plight of birds is catastrophic and is getting worse. And that is one of the fundamental parts of the book, that we are so relentless in our exhaustion of the Earth's resources that birds are really up against it. And the numbers of birds threatened with extinction is increasing so rapidly. But I have deep hope because, you know, we have to have hope that we'll turn this around. And the critical thing about birds, as I say, is that they are like ambassadors for the rest of nature. They make us realise that we're connected to it all. And if we lose it, we lose so much. So I am hopeful. And birds have this powerful hold over us, and they will undoubtedly be at the heart of any positive changes that we have.
And that was Mark Cocker talking to Monocle editor Andrew Tuck about his new book, Birds and People, which you can get now. You're listening to Midori House.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be leafing through the North American front pages, and we'll bring you the finale of this week's Summer Postcards from World Leaders, and we'll be hearing why political leaders do indeed deserve a summer holiday.
Everyone needs a holiday, and political leaders are no different. Let them fall asleep on the beach while reading the Joe Nesbo they picked up at the airport. Let them struggle to remember how to say three ice creams, please, in Spanish.
But first, here's Barney with the headlines.
Thanks, Emma. The United States has announced it'll be closing a number of embassies on Sunday because of security concerns. The State Department says the step is precautionary, but it gave no details of specific threats or of which missions would be closed. Ariel Castro, the Cleveland bus driver who abducted, imprisoned and tortured three women, has been sentenced to life in prison plus 1,000 years with no parole. The sentence came after one of his victims confronted him in court, saying he'd put her through 11 years of hell. Italy's former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi says a prison sentence against him for tax fraud, confirmed by the country's Supreme Court, was completely unfounded. He said he didn't deserve this treatment, and he again denied any wrongdoing, saying he'd always fulfilled his duties at work and in public life. Tunisian troops exchanged fire with militants near the Algerian border 3 days after gunmen killed 8 soldiers in one of the deadliest attacks on the country's security forces in decades. A mining company in Australia has been found guilty of desecrating an Aboriginal site in the Northern Territory and fined $150,000. OM Manganese was accused of causing the collapse of part of the two women sitting down site near Tennant's Creek in July 2011. 15 years after Washington DC's medical marijuana law was passed by voters, the first dispensary has opened in the US Capitol. Capital City Care began selling pharmaceutical-grade organic medical marijuana to local residents of the District of Columbia on Thursday. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back at 9 o'clock in the morning London time. That's just under 27 minutes from now with another check of the world news. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It is time now for the fifth and final part of our week-long series on holiday postcards from world leaders as they embark on their summer breaks.
Today we hear from Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson, who tells us where Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, fresh from another election victory in the upper house for his LDP party last month, will be going on his holidays this year.
He's having a staycation this year. He's staying in Japan and he's having a two-location holiday. One is his summer house by Lake Kawaguchi, which is in Yamanashi Prefecture. Very nice place near Mount Fuji.
Japan's Mount Fuji has been announced as a World Cultural Heritage Site by the UNESCO World Heritage Committee. The 3,776-metre-high mountain is climbed by around 300,000 people every year in the months of July and August. Many Japanese see it as a spiritual place.
The last time he was Prime Minister, he only took one day off in the summer. This year he's taking 11 days, so he's clearly relaxed a little since his last stint as Prime Minister. He must need the break. Maybe he feels he deserves it after the two election victories he's had. But he's not generally known for his summer style, and he's not really, you know, the holidaying type. And, you know, in fact, when the Japanese cabinet goes into cool biz mode at the beginning of summer, and they wear open neck shirts, that makes the headlines. So it's not a natural mode for the Japanese Prime Minister. And they've all taken very little holiday. It's 3 days here, 1 day there. And it really fits in with this pattern in Japan that Japanese people do not like to take holidays. And the fascinating statistics about the worker is given on average 18.1 days of holiday and they only take 8.9 days of that allowance. They can't persuade people to take holidays here. So I think this year Prime Minister Abe is leading by example, encouraging people to leave their houses. Honestly, I think it's a cultural thing here that people feel they're inconveniencing others if they take summer holidays that are too long. And noticeably, the one Prime Minister who was very happy to take a nice, healthy holiday was Prime Minister Koizumi, who was a very long-standing Prime Minister in the 2000s and a very interesting character, very charismatic figure. And so I think it's maybe down to personality and partly down to the sort of cultural resistance to taking time off. Most politicians holiday in Japan, so you don't really have this culture of, you know, living the high life in Tuscany and it looking bad while some, you know, people back at home are suffering austerity. They tend to favour holidays in Japan anyway, so they're like the rest of the population, so you don't really have so much of the them and us situation that you might have in other countries. It's so important in Japan. The number of domestic tourists is massive. Japan, surprisingly, doesn't get so many foreign visitors. They're making a big push to encourage more people to come to Japan.
That was Fiona Wilson there on Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's holiday plans.
Sounds like fun.
Doesn't it just?
Well, before we bid bon voyage to those world leaders we've heard about this week, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield gives us his thoughts on why all the heads of government do indeed deserve a little break this summer.
It's our fault, really. We want our leaders to be just like us, normal like us. And then they act like us by deciding to go on holiday, preferably somewhere hot, preferably somewhere where they can wear shorts or go for a swim in the sea. And then we moan. Barack Obama is in Hawaii. David Cameron is in Ibiza. How can they go on holiday when there's a recession? How can they be grinning from ear to ear when there's a crisis in Syria? How can they go to the beach when... Well, just how can they? We need to relax about their relaxing. Everyone needs a holiday, and political leaders are no different. Let them fall asleep on the beach while reading the Joe Nesbo they picked up at the airport. Let them struggle to remember how to say three ice creams, please, in Spanish. Let them valiantly resist the temptation to hit their 7-year-old son's long hop into the sea for six when playing beach cricket. We should not care where they go either. Or, more to the point, they should not care whether we care where they go. So scrap the domestic holiday or the low-cost airline flight to show you're a man of the people. If the only way you can get away from it all is by sitting on a beach in the Bahamas, go for it. There are, of course, exceptions. France's foreign minister went on holiday to Tunisia a month before President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali was ousted. There is just one concession they have to accept. When there is a real crisis, they need to pack up and come home. Some leaders seem to find this part difficult. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, President George W. Bush was on holiday at his ranch in Texas. When riots broke out in London in 2011, British Prime Minister David Cameron was in Tuscany. Bush decided to stay in Texas for 4 days before bothering to venture across to Louisiana to stare at the devastation from the safety of a helicopter. Cameron felt it was more important to make up with a Tuscan waitress he had failed to tip than return immediately to Downing Street. A relaxed president, one who has played bat and ball with his teenage daughter, had a line until lunchtime, got drunk on cocktails that no one can quite say for certain what they contain. That is the sort of leader who, once he returns, will be able to make clear-headed decisions on matters of policy. And if their holidays are anything like that of most middle-aged fathers with school-age kids, they'll be happy to head back to the relative peace of the office as soon as possible.
Foreign editor Steve Bloomfield there, rounding off our week of holiday postcards from presidents and prime ministers around the world.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with a word from our man in Belgrade.
Who's that big handsome thing getting all the looks on the beach, attracting envious glances by the pool, and too many amorous advances in the sun-dappled cafe? That's right, it's Monocle Mediterraneo, our big, bold, large-format newspaper that reports from the sunnier southern European spots each summer. Our editors have been scouring ports on the rise and plage for pleasure to bring you a host of reads to enjoy with your Aperol this vacation season.
In the design section, we kick back in two stunning holiday residences, a mid-century gem on the volcanic island of Pantelleria and a beautifully crafted fortress in the Atlas Mountains. We also go on an architour around the Sarrià Sant Gervasi district of Barcelona and uncover some beautifully intact post-war designs.
In the edit section, we relax and take a break by the beach while we await our food and drink to be served, courtesy of four Mediterranean chefs, including the number one chef in the world. And to keep in shape, we travel to the surf towns of Arachira, Sesme and Batroun to catch a few waves and a bit of sunshine too.
Make sure you get your copy of Monocle Mediterraneo. It's on newsstands now, or order a copy from monocle.com. You'll be the envy of all the lounger lizards.
It's 8:41 a.m. here in London. You're listening to Midori House with Phil Hahn and Emma Nelson.
It's time now to check in with one of Monocle's correspondents around the world. And joining us on the line from Belgrade is Guy Delaney. Good morning, Guy. How are you?
Very good indeed. Thank you very much.
Excellent stuff. Let's begin with the launch of a new airline, Air Serbia.
Air Serbia, indeed. Has anybody there ever travelled on Yat Airways by any chance?
No, but I'm sure you're just about to tell us exactly what it's like.
Well, if you like flying on planes with a patina, Yat Airways was definitely your airline of choice. I just flew them back from Milan to Belgrade a couple of weeks ago. First of all, they delayed the flight from 6:30 in the evening to just before midnight at only a couple of days' notice. And then you get on board and it's this... Honestly, it's a 1970s Boeing 737 with all the original typefaces from the 70s, which of course is lovely.
I was about to say that has a bit of a romance to it, but I'm sure the safety elements.
Maybe, yeah.
One would hope had been slightly brought up to date.
Well, the bizarre thing is that Yat Airways was the old airline of Yugoslavia, and when people get all romantic and nostalgic about what Yugoslavia was, they always bring up Yat and say that our airline was one of the best in the world. People loved the cabin crew, the quality of our engine. Engineers was just staggering, and they would have to be to keep these aeroplanes up in the sky. But then I talk to other people, and they say that in France, Yat, J-A-T, was known as jamais à temps, never on time. So perhaps not so good as all that. But it has gone. As of yesterday, Yat is no more, because, as you say, Air Serbia has come in, and this is a joint venture between the state of Serbia and Etihad Airways. Etihad, very serious, relatively new player in the long-haul airline game, but known for its high quality of service, very new fleet, and general aura of luxury, which is everything that Yat wasn't really. They've taken a 49% stake in the company, but crucially, they're also taking over the management of Yat, which, as you can imagine, is going to be a big deal because, of course, when you've got a legacy enterprise from the socialist days of the former Yugoslavia that's somehow been limping on, you can imagine it needs a bit of updating.
And this, go ahead. Well, this is just another move by Etihad, isn't it? Because they also have stakes in Virgin Australia as well as Air Berlin. So it's really them trying to get a stranglehold, I guess, in the domestic European Asian market, isn't it?
You know, I was wondering what exactly their game was, because you look at Yat and you think this isn't an obvious candidate for a takeover. Surely there's a different European airline you could have gone for if you wanted to get into the regional game in Europe. So after the presentation yesterday that launched Air Serbia, I collared the chief executive of Etihad, James Hogan, and asked him what was in it for Etihad.
Well, what's in it for Etihad is we have a different business model. We've demonstrated through other aviation investments we're creating a global airline. It's about connectivity. The Balkans, as a crossroad to the world, has huge opportunity. From a top-line perspective, we can improve the quality of the revenue. We can also reduce the unit cost and move Air Serbia into profitability. But the tourism business opportunity as a region is considerable, and we believe we're going to be very well positioned to take advantage of that.
I mean, Yat was in a notably terrible state. Weren't there other partners you could have gone for?
We obviously have looked at the business model. As we said in the presentation, we've restructured the deal. The past is the past. I wasn't here. We have a clean sheet of paper. We recapitalise the airline. We move forward. We have no doubt we'll move the airline to profitability.
What does this tell us about Etihad's future plans in Europe and for making these sort of partnerships with other airlines?
Well, we operate 78 aircraft today. We're going to acquire a further 70 aircraft. So organically, we're growing in our own right. But aviation isn't about how many planes you have. It's how you work smarter. It's how you achieve connectivity for your customer. And that's what we're doing with all our partnerships. And it's winning for us.
You can make money from it.
We wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
There you go. It's a profitable enterprise, or potentially, that's what Etihad say. As you can imagine, eyebrows being raised to the ceiling all around Belgrade at this deal. Lots of people saying they'll be gone within 3 years and so will Air Serbia. But Etihad saying, well, look at Air Seychelles. We took over the management of them, took a minority stake in them, and now they're profitable. If we can do it with them, we can do it with Air Serbia.
We were talking a couple of hours ago on another program here on Monocle 24 that three Hungarian businessmen are bringing a new national carrier called Solyom Hungarian Airlines. Apparently they have backing from Emirates. are we spotting a pattern here, Guy? And if so, how much of a hub is this region becoming?
Well, I think if you look at Belgrade as a location, it's the bridge between the East and the West in many ways. It's in Southeast Europe, but obviously a lot of people would consider it very much part of Europe as a whole. But it's very close to places like Istanbul and Russia as well. So it's an ideal sort of a bridging station. Serbia in particular is in a unique situation because it has free trade agreements with both the European Union and with Russia. So that potentially puts it in a good position. But with all of these countries in this Balkan region, there's one thing they've got in common. They're economically underdeveloped, as a lot of companies would see it. And these are companies who are coming in the main from very mature markets, and they're looking for anywhere that they can get a toehold and find some sort of expansion. And they're clearly seeing potential of some sort in the Balkans. Whether it plays out or not is another question, but there's room for growth and they want to be first in there.
Absolutely. It will be fascinating to see what happens. But let's move on to another topic, which is garnering headlines where you are. The Serbian government had a bit of a reshuffle.
Indeed it did. We've lost one of the coalition partners. The United Region of Serbia is out of the governing coalition, so we're now down to two parties, the Socialists and the Progressives. This has been long flagged up as on its way, and nobody really knew how it was going to pan out. Everybody suspected it was going to be a case of first Deputy Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić, who is the most powerful and popular politician in Serbia, consolidating his power somehow. But he likes to play this game of stepping back just when everybody expects him to step forward. So he actually relinquished one of his portfolios, the defence portfolio. He's kept hold of this first deputy prime minister title. And I think the perception is he's biding his time until it's politic and acceptable to hold elections, when one suspects the progressives will be in a much more dominant position.
Finally, Guy, you were talking about trying to sort of resurrect Serbia's international image. Bell Pottinger, the PR company that by reputation quite likes a challenge, has organised a junket to Serbia to try to sell the country as a place to invest. How did that go?
You know, somebody called Bell Pottinger reputation washers to me. And Serbia, of course, is a country whose reputation needs an awful lot of scrubbing after all the wars of the 1990s, the atrocities that were committed by ethnic Serbs and the problems with the Serb state getting involved with that as well. So Bell Pottinger is just trying to, has actually been employed by the Import-Export Agency of Serbia, this is part of the government, to try and say to people, look, we're ready for business and we could be quite good at it. And so they were taking people around places like Microsoft, which has a coding operation here. If you ever open a PDF in Microsoft Word, that's been coded in Serbia. And then there was a packaging company, Fiat, Panasonic. But what all these companies were saying is, we're feeling a bit lonely. We thought when we came in 5, 6, 7 years ago, everybody would be joining the rush. But nobody has. And they believe it's still this reputation Serbia has that's putting other companies off.
Guy Delaunay, thank you very much indeed at trying to sell Serbia to us. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
And we'll be having a flick through this morning's North American front pages in just a little bit. But before we do, it's time for a bit of music. This is California's very own Milo Green with 1957.
That was Milo Green with the song 1957.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It's now time for us to leaf through this morning's North American front pages, and we're now joined by everyone's favourite New Yorker, Danny Giacopelli.
I love that song. I never heard that one.
It was lovely. Instructions, Danny, were to bring us something nice and Friday and lively.
You know, I tried. I was on the bus coming into work, and it was raining, and I tried the best to find something that's light.
You didn't succeed.
I failed
you came
miserably.
Up with the possible Al-Qaeda threat closes all U.S. embassies on Sunday. Thanks.
Execution drugs and a horrible, we'll get to that. I don't want to give it
you
away.
You have one fun one, the Wiener scandal. That's always fun.
I don't know if that's very fun.
And it's if we have time, we have a kleptomaniac
infidelity
band.
And horrible crimes. So, okay, as we heard Barney said, the U.S. is closing all of its embassies in the Middle East and parts of Asia on Sunday. Due to some kind of unspecified terror threat. And of course, lots of embassies in the Middle East are open on Sundays, and those that are will be closed. And nobody really knows why. I mean, it seems to me something pretty big, some kind of fairly large terror threat had to occur for them to do this. I mean, it's a kind of big move.
Do you think they're just taking extra precautions in the wake of what happened, obviously, in Benghazi?
Yeah, they say they're doing it out of an abundance of caution, end quote. But again, you don't really do that across an entire region unless there's a kind of specific threat that you're trying to prevent against.
And you don't publicize it either.
And you don't publicize it, you just do it.
There's a couple of interesting things happening on Sunday. I'm just reading here. It's President Barack Obama's 52nd birthday on Sunday, and it's also the day that Iran is going to inaugurate Rouhani as its new president. So there's no way to see whether any of these things are linked, but I guess it's just two kind of interesting tidbits.
Exactly. So moving on, let's talk now about Samantha Power, which we've covered in the past as it was happening. So she's now the United States' ambassador to the United Nations. She was confirmed. Her confirmation was due to a deal between the Republicans and the Democrats. It didn't seem likely at first that she would get confirmed, but, you know, she's a very strong foreign policy activist, human rights activist. And this obviously happened after Susan Rice became the National Security Advisor.
It is one of those things that at the point where people are beginning to question the Obama administration in terms of its freedom of speech policy, at least, to have someone with such a strong background in advocating human rights seems to introduce a bit of balance.
Yeah, it does. I mean, she's the author of a very popular book about genocide. And that's how it caught Obama's attention initially. She was a foreign policy advisor to Obama during his campaign. She's been with him for a very long time. So Obama's probably very pleased about this.
And I think in one of her very first speeches after she was nominated, you know, she came up very strongly against the United Nations' failure to really act with the crisis in Syria. Do we have any sense kind of what position she might be taking when she takes over the helm at the UN there and kind of what shift there potentially could be?
You know, I'm not really sure if there's anything that she said right now about Syria. I think she's probably thinking pretty carefully about what she's going to say, because whatever she does says, in this position at least, tends to, you know, often become policy, and people are don't want that to happen. So let's move a little bit closer to home now, to Texas, where a kind of slightly depressing story is coming out. Texas is running out of the drug in which it uses to execute people. So Texas has had a lot of problems with this. Actually, quite a few American states have had problems with this. They used to use this one drug in the execution cocktail. They ran out of the first drug a couple years back, so they moved to now this drug, which was previously used in euthanasia for animals. And now it seems they only have a couple months left of this supply.
It is one of those things. Other countries are now beginning to realize that if they stop the supply, I think this is happening in Italy, isn't it? Italy has said, right, if we don't supply you with this drug, then obviously you can't carry out executions.
Right.
It's almost forcing Texas' hand.
Yeah, that's what happened. So the supplier in Italy said, no, we don't want our drugs to be used. And a lot of suppliers are now kind of making pacts among themselves that they don't want these drugs to be used for this. So lots of shady stuff is going down. Georgia, for instance, is going through somewhat illegal means to require drugs now.
And then I think we quickly have time for two more stories. We have to save room for the klepto bear, lastly, but let's talk about Wiener.
Yeah, let's look at the New York Times. So the New York Times has this fascinating article about the plight of Huma Abedin, which is, of course, the wife of Anthony Wiener, would-be mayor of New York.
The very long-suffering and patient wife.
Yeah, the guy who just won't quit. Exactly. So the Times has this article. We all know that Huma stood by his side, Anthony Weiner's side, throughout all of this, press conferences. And now it seems that the Clinton family, which has supported her all the way through, is doing so now through through close associates. And they're advising her basically on what to do.
And Danny, you have 30 seconds to tell me about a bear that steals things.
Yeah, so if we go to the Edelweiss restaurant in Colorado Springs. A very favorite. There's a bear that's been seen on security footage, and it's stealing the rubbish bins. It's been caught on video. I could show you the video, but this is radio.
Just like the NSA stealing secrets, hey?
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Many thanks, Danny, for coming in and having a flick through this morning's North American pages. Many thanks as well to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Gaia Lutz. And our studio manager today was Toby Hammond.
Up next, after the news, Section D is Monocle's Design Hour. It'll be Ed. Your host for that will be Aled John. And Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. That's 8 a.m. London time. I hope you can join us for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Phil.
Goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.